Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Brian Levitt joins us in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. He's a senior strategist at Oppenheimer Funds. Brian, great to see you.
Good morning.
Here in New York. Let me ask you, first of all, just how you're paying attention to what's going on in Washington. I'm sure that you, like the rest of us, just curious what's going to happen here. But from an investment perspective, what do you make of what's going on?
Well, we're all obviously trying to read the tea leaves, and everybody's paying attention probably a little bit more to how bills become a law. You remember that from what was that song we used to sing?
Schoolhouse Rock, exactly.
Yeah. And so I like to look at things from the perspective of the bond market. I think that, you know, early on there was a reflation trade in the aftermath of the Trump election, and 10-year rates were going higher, and the composition of returns in the equity markets favored small caps, it favored value, and that was all on the expectation of pro-growth policies. And you've seen that reverse, David, and obviously it's reversed as we deal with the realities of governing 10-year yields in growth outperforming value, emerging markets outperforming the U.S., large caps outperforming small caps. So that's the market dealing with the realities of governing. And as an investor, we have to pay attention to this.
You mentioned the bond market. We've seen the equities market pull back a little bit this week. It seems like the equities market's reevaluating what's going on. What's happening in the bond space? Is it paying as close attention to D.C.?
Yeah, the bond market's paying a lot of attention, only to policy coming out of or legislation coming out of Congress, but also what the FOMC is going to do. Because, you know, we've had a Federal Reserve that's been very accommodative for a long time, and when they tried to raise interest rates, or when they did raise interest rates at the end of 2015, long rates came crashing in down to 135, and investors were concerned about a recession. And as soon as the FOMC backed off, long rates started to go back up again, the dollar abated, the economy started to do well, and then when Trump won, rates went up to 260. So short-term rates have been going up on expectations of a tightening Fed stance, long-term rates down a little bit. So we have to pay attention to that, because if this is a reflation trade, if we're going to get pro-growth policy, we shouldn't see a flattening yield curve. You should see a steepening yield curve.
Is this an FOMC that wanted to raise rates or had to raise rates?
Well, they were able to raise rates is the way I think we should put it. They were comfortable with a 4.8 or 4.7% unemployment rate. You had inflation expectations behaving, and, you know, break evens on tips climbing. You had credit spreads that were generally behaving, and you had a dollar that was relatively stable. So, you know, if Janet Yellen wants to leave her predecessor ample room to lower rates if we ever have another recession in this country or another disruption in economic activity, this was the window to do it. The problem now is if you extend out the dot plots to where the Fed governors believe it'll be in 2018 and 10-year rates don't move, it signals the Fed will likely have to back off from the 3 rate hikes this year, or the 4 rate hikes next year, or whatever they're signaling.
We were talking with Tony Dwyer yesterday of Canaccord Genuity about the prospect for a correction in the equity space. Are we seeing one now? Are we near? What are you seeing when you look at the equities markets?
Well, I think, corrections are obviously very hard to time. You know, a lot of investors ask me, how come we haven't had a correction for so long? That's actually not true. We did have a pretty meaningful correction from the summer of 2015 into February 2016. The S&P 500 was down about 15%. If you excluded Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you were probably down 17-18%. So we have had a correction. They are hard to time. What we've been telling investors since the beginning of the year is that there's going to be a pause in markets, primarily as we deal with the realities of governing. There was simply too much excitement around tax cuts, fiscal spending, and, you know, all of a sudden we're sitting here, it's March, we're dealing with healthcare, and we're going to start thinking about the midterm elections pretty soon. Right. So it's the markets are dealing with that reality.
Sobering to realize we're right back to it. You've got a whole note that centers on What you tell clients who are fearful of getting into this market right now because they're worried about getting in too late or facing the kind of correction we were just talking about. What is the advice that you give them?
Well, I think the first thing is that investors always believe that they're living in the most uncertain of times, and they always come up with a variety of reasons to not be invested in markets. And as we were saying earlier, you know, at the beginning of the recovery, it was China's too strong, dollar's too weak, we don't have enough oil, I don't like the president. And today it's China's too slow. The dollar's too strong. We have too much oil, and I don't like the president, right? So they always come up with rationale. What I remind people, even if you got a big, if you inherited a big sum of money in October 1987 on the eve of the massive correction, if you had put that money in that day, that put $100,000 in, the next day you have $75,000. Today it's worth $1.3 million. If you had put in a few thousand dollars every month, you would be worse off than had you just put it in on the day of that correction.
A couple of ways to segue into talking about energy here. Just want to flag that TransCanada has gotten a presidential permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, that crossing the Bloomberg right now. That's something that President Trump had promised we were expecting to happen. So that news official today. I'm looking at Brent right now as well at $47.93 a barrel. How are you watching? How are you regarding energy right now?
Or the lack thereof.
The lack of energy.
You know, I believe we're in a secular bull market for equities, and we're in a malaise for commodities. There's certainly no shortage of supply. And, you know, the dollar's relatively strong. And in a strong dollar world, particularly given that commodities generally trade in dollars, it's a headwind to commodity prices.
98.66.
Oh, yeah. Tom is in a March Madness malaise.
My Wolverines lost last night.
True. So that was not a good night for either of you.
I'm heading for a final two, and maybe David, one here.
Tonight, I'll be watching.
Good morning, everyone. Yeah, Kansas. Good morning. Sirius XM Channel 119. Lawrence.
Yeah.
Kansas getting it done. Huge. Purdue, boiler down. That's it. I'm done with the brackets. David, continue. Yeah. UNC continues. Dominant.
Tom tries to pull himself back together. We're looking ahead to next Wednesday. That's when the UK is expected to trigger Article 50. And you've been thinking a lot about just what happens next here, sort of working with them on an exit from the European Union, but also trade deal as well. How mammoth an undertaking is this going to be?
I think it's very mammoth. Yeah. And we're trying to do a lot in a very, very short period of time. So even negotiating the exit and the cost of the exit and what does it mean for EU citizens living in the UK and how are they going to be able to fill out those 85 pages to maintain rights to live in the UK. And it is just massive. And then trying to negotiate access, whether it's to the single market or in a free trade agreement, and what does that mean for the mobility of people? Also at a time when we're going to have elections in France and elections in Germany, this is very difficult to do. And the attempt is to complete it by the fall of 2018 into 2019.
What is the opportunity in European equities? Let's review this. They give me a bigger dividend as a general statement.
That's a general statement.
They don't do share buybacks as a general statement like we do. So the all-in cash-on-cash yield day one, January 1 of every year, what is it, about the same as we are, or is it less?
Well,
when you blend in dividend and share buybacks, are they the same or are they less?
Well, they've been less, and it's been problematic for investors. But what you also have to recognize is that cyclically, Europe is in a good part of the cycle. If it wasn't for some of this political risk, I think European equities would be higher from here. You know, weaker currencies have been helpful, particularly you think about the UK, and investors ask why the FTSE do so well in the aftermath of Brexit. And a lot of those companies are exporters. Weaker pound, weaker euro has been beneficial to export-oriented companies. The cycle's helpful, policy's accommodative, and expectations are lower. So, you know, international markets don't necessarily always have to underperform. I think investors over the last number of years have come around to the idea that the U.S. is the only game in town, and that's not necessarily true.
Did you watch the game last night, Tom?
I watched a little bit of it. I had a running report from our executive producer.
Okay, she was keeping you apprised.
Basket by, you know, dunk by dunk. It was like a Dunkelberg game, talking to our NFIB expert. As well. It'll be fun. I mean, this weekend, when does North Carolina play?
Tonight at 7 o'clock. So you don't have to stay up too late for it.
Is that like a Madison? I know they're at Madison Square Garden.
I think that's right. Yeah. You're going to head down?
I don't know.
We'll get tickets. Tom and I will be there.
Brian Levitt, with us with Oppenheimer Funds. What's the mystery right now for investors? Is it, you and I talked earlier about investing without a risk-free rate, investing within a great distortion, central banks, the massive yield divergence worldwide. What's the mystery out there that we haven't talked about?
I think the biggest mystery for investors is whether or not we can actually do better than 2% real GDP growth in the United States. And, you know, on the campaign trail, the idea of make America great again. I mean, I had the opportunity to see Donald Trump speak at the Economic Club of New York. Uh-huh. And one of the comments was, we're going to have 4%, 5%, 6% GDP growth. Right. And how do you get there? I mean, I've joked, you either have to have a lot of 30-year-olds, big gains in productivity, or some policy that could be a catalyst forward. So do we remain in this slow growth world, no cycle, no monetary tightening, or do we actually have a catalyst to drive the economy and markets higher?
All right, there's the mystery. What do you think about it?
Well, I think we're struggling with the realities of it. And I don't believe that this is the end of a bull market. Yep. In my mind, bull markets don't end with most Americans not liking equities. Now, we've become more optimistic lately, but that's only after 8 years of hating this. And so I don't believe that bull markets are going to end with most Americans not participating. Leading indicators of the U.S. okay, actually been pretty good, and Federal Reserve that's going to probably do this at a more measured pace. To me, that's not how cycles end. I just think that we're now taking back some of the optimism that we had experienced in the aftermath of the election.
How worried are you about political risk? And you look to Europe, had the election in the Netherlands, looking ahead to the election in France. What does the election in the Netherlands tell you about the election in France, and indeed how big a risk is that?
Well,
kind of
I think
risk event is the French election.
I think the election in the Netherlands was the first of its kind, of a first major hallmark vote that didn't go in the direction of less Europe or national populism. And so from Brexit to Donald Trump, the natural extension was the Netherlands and now France.
Does it make it an outlier, or does it tell you there's a reverse?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, I think we've all gotten to the point now where we don't want to make predictions on politics anymore in the aftermath of Brexit and Trump's victory. We will see. I mean, Marine Le Pen in France has pulled higher in the polls. Obviously, it remains to be seen if she can win a runoff in the French elections. And she's not running to be dictator of France, right? So we'll have to work within the system there, the same way Donald Trump is working in the system in the United States. So there are checks and balances. But clearly, the election of Le Pen, a more Eurosceptic, would be viewed negatively by markets, at least in the near term.
Do you have to diversify as much internationally, or do you diversify across companies? Is it sector bets, or is it still, you know, investment 101 that we knew 20 years ago where you pick a country?
Well, I think investors, for the first thing investors should do is, if they do have a plan, they should be consistent, because far too often investors are trying to chase performance in a particular size, style, region. And what you find, we run the largest emerging markets fund in the industry. What we find is outflows when things are getting better and inflows when things have already gotten good. So we tell investors to be consistent with their plan. If I look at the world, and I look at world market capitalization, I want to think about core allocation to equities. Emerging markets are about 15% of that. International markets, depending on where we are, 35, 40% of that. So to only invest in the United States would be akin to only investing east or west of the Mississippi. It doesn't make a lot of sense. We think there's great companies all around the world, and we like to take a view on those companies all around the world.
When you look to emerging markets in the Pacific, what stands out to you right now? What's attractive in that space, which we can paint with such a broad brush?
Well, I mean, if you're going to paint it with a broad brush, stands out is that cyclically those economies are improving. You know, you've seen a massive policy response from China, and you've seen growth trend higher there, growth trend higher in places like India and Russia and others. You've seen inflation come down. You have positive real yields. I mean, people often say to me, how could I be in emerging markets if the Fed Fed's going to raise rates and scale back their balance sheet. When they attempted to do that in 2014, 2015, 2016, EM sold off. But that was when EM was in the worst part of the cycle. That was when real yields weren't positive in the emerging markets. It's a very different story today. And emerging markets have been powering through, even as the Fed signals three interest rate hikes this year.
Brian Levitt, thank you for the briefing with Oppenheimer Funds this morning. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. Joining us now, thoughtful discussion on a Friday with Peter Tay. We're just going to stop things and stop with the news flow. Maybe actually talk about the longer perspective. I mean, how many miles do you fly a year across this nation looking for deals? Do you have a number?
I don't, but I fly probably 150 or 200 days a year.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you're out there. I don't want to talk about Warren Buffett's size. I don't want to talk about the size that gets you in the headlines of Wall Street M&A. I want to talk about an average industrial company out there. Nobody listening knows the name of it. They've decided they've got to do a transaction to better everyone, the shareholders. Probably there's some senior officials that want to cash out, if you will. Is the dialogue the same now as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
That's a really good question. I would argue that at some level it's identical, which is that I think 99% of all M&A transactions are driven by some strategic imperative, which genuinely makes sense. I do think that in an environment where we have so much volatility and so much uncertainty, and that change and surprise has become a backdrop we all have to deal with, I think parts of the dialogue have changed.
And that company has their competitors, publicly traded competitors, private equity, and you know how dumb they are, and foreign investors as well, right? So you've got like eight more phone calls to make than you had to make 20 years ago.
There's plenty of competition for assets, and there are plenty of assets coming to market. So one of the things that I was actually just discussing with a client yesterday, actually, is that we are in a world today where every single asset, every single opportunity for an M&A trade is effectively auctioned.
Auctioned and priced.
The market has become so efficient.
I was making a joke there about private equity, Mr.
The emails are flying into your ear.
God, I hate me. I'm going to have death threats now. But seriously, private equity can be a very shrewd, skill-based expertise. How have they changed the dialogue for publicly traded companies if you're competing against, just to take a name, Carlyle?
Well, I think there was a period of time where private equity, frankly, had a pretty easy time of it. Companies, and I'm able to go back to the 80s. Companies had a great deal of opportunity for cost cutting, for restructuring, financial engineering. These days, the degree of sophistication in the way these companies are run, we were talking earlier, Tom, about the sophistication of the management teams in today's Fortune 500 companies, so much higher. I think they've got a much tougher job making money. Mm. And we obviously have a very, very friendly financing backdrop, but we haven't seen financial sponsor M&A dominate the market.
Here we are 4 months in to 2017. You've given us a peek at the landscape. How does it look for M&A? How's the M&A business doing 4 months in?
Well, if we just take a look at the activity levels, January was smoking hot. February really went into a lull. And the first part of March, in the first 2 weeks of March, we made up all the February volume. Wow. So it's been fairly volatile. We're running at volume levels that are roughly 10% ahead of last year, so a little bit ahead. Overall activity levels in terms of number of transactions, roughly flat. So I would say that it's steady. We have seen some bigger transactions come through, and probably the thing that surprised me more than anything else has been how prominent cross-border deals have been in the
Interesting.
Market.
Let's come back and talk about that. Peter Tagg with us with Citigroup, taking a look at the more international landscape. I mentioned Mr. Buffett earlier with his assistance from Brazil Capital. Among others. That's a theme that's clearly out there. Peter Tagg with us with Citigroup in mergers and acquisitions. When foreign money comes in, how do they acquire management expertise? How do they make smart decisions, given they've got a million or a gajillion dollars? How do they affect a smart review to choose what to do with all that money?
Well, I think that management teams and talent generally has become a theme in M&A, and I think companies. I'm speaking broadly. Companies have become aware of the importance of both operational talent and managerial talent in terms of making transactions successful. So it ends up where today, and you asked me earlier, Tom, about differences between the market today and the market of yesterday. I think one of the things that has really changed is the focus which our clients have on talent and how that can make a difference in success or failure in a transaction.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the role the elections played, this new administration in Washington, D.C. Aside from the regulatory space, what that's meaning for M&A right now, you see someone like Ajit Pai being named to head the FCC. How's that changing the possibility for M&A, the people who are put in place not to approve these deals necessarily, but just to sort of set the landscape in Washington?
Yeah, I think some of the names that have been put forward in the regulatory landscape are broadly seen as more constructive for the transactional environment than the prior administration's choices. That said, it remains to be seen how things play out, and I'm quite confident that things are always going to get evaluated on a case-by-case basis.
Did you see how smooth he was in answering
smooth.
That question?
Constructive.
It's amazing how he can insult President Obama without sounding like an insult.
Is there much continuity, though, between administrations? In other words, how radical is the change usually when you have a different administration coming in?
Well, of course, most of the people that work in justice
or staff attorneys,
they're staff, yeah. And they're still there. And frankly, we're all glad of that because the expertise is specific, and we depend on that knowledge and expertise because as we affect transactions, if a new administration meant you had to have a whole new group get completely re-educated, nothing would ever get done. So we're quite pleased by that continuity.
You know, we hear a lot about the soft data across the board, from small companies to big companies. As you talk to clients and executives, what are they saying about the prospects for the economy going forward?
I think there's an awful lot of optimism right now about the prospects for the economy. The basic principles of the Trump administration platform has been fiscal stimulus, deregulation, and tax reform, all of which are broadly good for business and all of which broadly are good for M&A.
How big a variable is what the Federal Reserve is doing? How concerned are your clients about rates going up?
Honestly, not concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the current betting is on 3 rate rises for the year. But frankly, hikes of that nature are barely putting a dent.
We ought to start interviewing M&A guys to do economics, you know, just because we're so far from any neutral rate. We're so far from restrictive and such. Help me with the CFO reality. If we finally get a vector of higher rates, what is your experience of how CFOs act when we begin to see rising rates? Is it everybody's on the phone, let's go, let's go, let's go? Is it lemmings off the cliff? Do they become defensive? What do they do?
No, I think it's as long as the rate rises and the rate environment is reasonably predictable, I don't think it changes much at all. In other words, I think we can see a much higher rate environment, frankly, and still expect that we would have a fairly robust M&A backdrop to that. That's because it all boils into valuation, it all boils into planning, and as long as what crushes our business is uncertainty and unpredictability. And so I think what we're looking at right now is an environment which is broadly predictable.
Mm. So come on, this president's predictable and diminishes uncertainty?
But you raise a good point. Of course, I was specifically talking about the rate environment.
Right. It's Friday. I'm making a joke.
But I do think again, if this president can affect change off the platform that he has articulated, and so far I think he is working hard to make that happen, I think that's going to be a good environment for business and for M&A.
Just read a headline a few minutes ago about SoftBank and this new $100 billion vision fund that it's created. When a variable like that is introduced, how does that change the M&A space?
There have been some very large pools of capital formed over the last five, pretty much since the crisis. We've had an astonishing rise of some very large pools of capital. It absolutely affects the market in the sense that whether it's very large private equity funds, very large sovereign wealth funds, the Vision Fund, those pools of capital are looking to go to work. That has definitely had an impact on valuations. It has definitely had an impact on the way we think about auctioning assets, in other words, broadening the base of potential acquirers for assets. But frankly, I wouldn't say that it has been catalytic in the sense that I don't think that's the reason why we've had a strong M&A market for the last few years, not that alone anyway.
When someone says the word – one final question. When someone says the word synergy, which is a word I hate, what does synergy mean to a grizzled pro like you? You're sitting in some office and you're exhausted. You had to go through O'Hare and sit on the runway for three. You don't have a Gulfstream, do you? You can use ours.
I borrow yours?
No. Well, we have a G3. It's not a G5, but that's okay. But, you know, you're on a plane delay in O'Hare. You finally get to where you're going. You're going to do a transaction. And they're like, synergy. How do you handle that question about we need synergies?
Well, there's a short answer and there's a long answer. The short answer is synergy, if that broadly is defined as the benefits associated with pushing two companies together. If there wasn't a benefit, we wouldn't be doing the transaction. And that would certainly curtail my level of personal activity.
Isn't it just French for cost cutting?
It can be. But I'm not going to get behind the notion that that's all it means. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've had a number of interviews, particularly in Davos, about Sir Martin Sorrell's on this. The religion of cost-cutting is the be-all and end-all, not only to transactions, to be fair, but just to modern business. Do you see that? Cost-cutting is the religion?
I think cost-cutting's been the religion of modern business since the financial crisis. I think cost-cutting in an environment where many, many companies pulled in their horns, decided they needed to deleverage. Transactional activity was sharply curtailed by the crisis. I think cost-cutting became the watchword, and I think it has remained a watchword. But that said, I think the inability of many companies to continue indefinitely to drive cost-cutting is one of the things that's been very, very good for the M&A markets over the last several years.
It strikes me where there is uncertainty is in the tax space and in the trade space, that you know we hear Washington talking about doing certain things, but retaliation there might be as a result of that. How worried are you about that affecting cross-border deals going forward?
I agree with you. I think those are the two biggest question marks for my business. What I would say is right now the market hasn't seen anything or heard anything that is close enough on the horizon and definite enough for it to take specific action. Mm. I do think that if we get to a point later in this year or next year where tax reform has firmed up in a way that it is easier to identify what the changes are that are going to get made, and it starts to be close right enough that it's right in the near-term landscape, it could really affect the business.
Very generous with your time this morning. Peter Tagg, thank you so much. We're sitting here. We don't do enough of this, folks, just to talk about mergers and acquisitions, and I much more like the phrase transactions and combinations, which I think goes much more to the behavioral aspect. Is companies actually have to talk to each other to get this done. It's not as clinical as M&A. It is very important to regroup at 9:30 on a Friday. Get ready for the thinking of the weekend. David Gurr, one of the great moments coming up, not this weekend, is John Tucker, the opening of the 401k envelope.
Yeah.
To see the agony.
I'll hold your hand, Tom.
No, well, my 401k is a double leveraged all cash fund, which is fine. But Tucker's like actually in the market.
And
we'll see what his agony is, which means it's a good time to talk to Julian Emanuel of UBS on the use of synthetics, derivatives, and also within the equity market. Just as a general rule, Julian, we've heard interview after interview over the last 5 or 6 years. It's a single digit world. 12 months trailing, the Dow up 18%. The S&P 500 up 15%, the NASDAQ comp up 22%, Apple infected. In all that, that's not a single-digit world, is it?
No, and the whole concept of markets being single-digit world, you look at the long-run average, the number's 8% or whatever, but gains tend to come in clusters. And, you know, that's why, to us, despite the fact that we think the market is probably not on as firmer ground in the near term because of a number of things, you need to stay invested here.
So I know you don't like to talk individual stocks. There's a compliance issue in general counsel and all that. But if I look at a major toothpaste company, it's trading at a 26 multiple. If you gross out this year, maybe it's a 25 multiple. Is that nifty 50 like? Is there a parallel even before my ute back to the glory of Mad Men? Are we living in a Mad Men valuation?
Toothpaste is expensive. At this point, there are lots of pockets in the market that are at historically high valuations. And that is part of our concern in the near term, particularly since first quarter GDP doesn't look as strong as perhaps the Fed would have wanted. But there's also areas, financials, healthcare, technology, that are reasonably valued.
And David, I bring this up because the Nifty 50 valuation came out of the Eisenhower deflation and disinflation of the early 50s. And there's a little bit, I don't want to overplay this because it's a completely different world than it used to be. But nevertheless, there's that inflation parallel there, if you would.
What's your outlook for inflation? How much is that weighing on the decisions you're making right now?
We think ultimately you're going to arrive at the Fed's 2% number. We think there's not going to be a ton of volatility in terms of inflation. The Fed has said that they're going to let it creep north of 2, south of 2, et cetera. But, you know, ultimately for us, the important thing going forward in a world where, you know, 3% and above GDP is just not the glide path anymore. The Fed's telling you the number is 2. We think it's 2.4 this year and 2.5 next year. You need to stick with companies that can grow their earnings in that type of environment.
Yeah, this is becoming, I think, a theme on the show today, Tom, the new expectations for GDP. Of course, we heard the candidate Trump saying that we could see 4 or 5%.
Okay.
Everybody's
reevaluating it. But I don't mean to interrupt, David, but Julian, it's a fan distribution. There's a lot of different opinions about what GDP is going to do. Let's be clear on that.
No question about it. And again, part of the concern for us right now is the fact that there's this unexplained sort of softness in the consumer in the first quarter. And you've seen the wobbles in the credit markets and you've seen oil sell off. Is there more to it than meets the eye? The Fed hasn't intimated that there is, but I think the economic data over the next several weeks is going to be very important to watch.
You say you see opportunities in financials. Is that based on valuations? Is that based on the prospects for regulatory change? Why is the sector attractive to you?
It's really in all of the above. And Tom talked about our derivatives background. For us, the 4 or 5 reasons, catalysts for financials, what we would call is sort of a portfolio of call options. It's interest rates. It's deregulation. It is the fact that after 10 years of inherent entrenched bearishness on the part of investors in the sector, that's unwinding and that's a slow process. And despite the fact that the yield curve has come in incrementally over the last several months, you're still at points on the curve where banks can make plenty of money.
Your brief is domestic, of course, but I wonder how you're reacting to what we're seeing from Credit Suisse and from Deutsche Bank. We're seeing the dilution to them trying to raise money. How do you process what's happening over in Europe?
Well, I think, you know, that kind of activity, what it tells you is that if anything, It's trying to prepare for a more competitive environment versus the U.S. banks, because in a deregulating Washington, the banks in the U.S. are going to be on a firmer footing. So it's really sort of upping the arms in the artillery to compete.
We talk about deregulation in Washington with a broad brush, and I wonder – so, what would make a notional difference to you, or to these banks, rather? To, you know, if we see regulations scaled back, what's likely to happen, do you think, and how much of a difference can that make?
We don't think there's going to be what I would call an aha moment. They're not rolling back Dodd-Frank in completitude. There's no question about it. But what would be interesting would be to see the stop in the bull market of hiring of compliance people. Okay, that's
a real bull market.
That has been the major bull market in the financial business for the last 6 or 7 years.
When I look, Julian, at what to do and what not to do within the blur of investment choices, what's the thing you want to avoid right now with long-term investment money?
You absolutely have to have emotional control here, Tom. You will hear stories when the market is running like this, your neighbor, the guy down the street, whatever, great stories, this stock, that stock. You at almost 19 times 2017, you have to maintain discipline and control.
Is the dumbest idea to like actually write down the valuation when the bear market 18% moved down and say, can I live with that? Because a lot of people listening don't even know what a bear market is anymore. They don't have a collective memory to recall that.
Well, we're not looking for the bear market.
I agree.
Now,
no, but you got to mentally be framed for it.
Absolutely. So what we're telling people is we're thinking that there's a 5 to 10% correction in here. What you have to do is look at your portfolio now and say to yourself, if we're down 10, am I a buyer? Okay, and if you're not, you need to get to sort of the sleeping point, whether it's raising cash or owning some put options.
This is a great conversation, particularly for Fridays. And John Tucker, I don't know if John Tucker's listening today, but Michael Barr, it's always good. We sedate Mr. Tucker. We have the opening of the 401k envelope. and Mr. Tucker, always good for entertainment.
Yes.
We'll be doing that. I believe it's next week. It could be the week following with
high ceremony.
Our good colleague, John Tucker. Julian Emanuel with us. Of UBS as we close out here and get to the weekend. help me here with the great debate at you, and UBS is so good at this. I mean, I think of the heritage of Jonathan Anderson years ago with UBS in China. Help me with the decision I have to make to do a domestic vanilla value growth portfolio, or in the old days, I'm going to dip into the foreign markets 4 or 5%. We don't do that anymore. We actually go into the foreign markets, which is which foreign market? Where's the which of big blue chip foreign stocks, emerging markets, China, something esoteric? What's the way to go there?
So this is one of these times where after hiding in the U.S. for as long as people have, you should be looking elsewhere. EM in general is sort of recovering. If you look at China, you know, given the fact that you've got a very important party Congress this fall, there's an argument to be made that things are going to stay on the straight and narrow there. The numbers have been pretty good. And then finally, there's Europe. We think that the gap in terms of valuation and in terms of earnings potential in Europe makes it attractive despite the political risk. So, you know, that's part of building a diversified portfolio, particularly at these valuations in the U.S.
Help us with the timing of doing that. We were talking earlier just about all the potential changes we could see when it comes to trade policy or tax policy. When you look internationally, how much does that weigh on your decision-making?
It definitely doesn't. So, you know, instead of you take an incrementalist approach. You figure out where you want to be in terms of your portfolio allocation and, you know, whatever that number is. And you do it in stages. And when you have patience like that, you can really let the market come to you. So if we get a little bit more volatility in front of the French elections, that's when you add to Europe.
How much are you paying attention to what's going on in Washington today? I talked about tax reform and trade policy. Does this portend anything about what's going to happen with those two other things? The debate over health care, the fact that this vote has been postponed here by 12, 15 hours?
We do not put a lot of credence in the idea that if this vote doesn't go the president's way, that tax reform is dead. If you look at the last year or so, the resilience of Donald Trump, his ideas, his approach, what have you. I mean, we've been surprised constantly. He's going to push forward with tax reform. It's going to take a while, but there will be a vote at some point.
When you say that, does UBS assume we will see the benefit of corporate tax reform that finally gets our corporations to compete with the rest of the world? Or are you talking personal tax reform?
Well, we do think that ultimately, if there is going to be a passed bill, you know, either late this year or early next year, there will be elements of both. The politicians are trying to get it all done.
So it's like a Tax Reform Act of 76, 78 kind of feel.
Yeah. Yeah. It does have the potential.
There's a Tip O'Neill down there willing to work.
Hiding out in the Hawk and Dove waiting to.
Yeah.
That's the problem right now. The problem is
where's
that,
the Tip O'Neill?
Is that the Republicans are not unified enough, let alone reaching across the aisle.
Is gridlock good for the stock market?
Excuse me. That was the best question. Why you make a note? That was the best question of the week. Continue.
At this point, we would say it isn't. Okay, there are times when it has proven, and look, again, up 250% since the lows in 2009, when you went through years of essentially gridlock on a lot of big issues. But now, at these valuations, at this lower growth trajectory, we've got to find new solutions.
In the final minute we've got with you, let's get a little technical here. The pros talk about buying volatility, going long volatility. It's awfully quiet out there. Do I just assume there's more agitation to come?
We think there is. It is really that this standoff in volatility is basically predicated, and this is now 4.5 months since the election, of the VIX not trading above 15. Very, very rare in history. But that is because basically when you look at it, the market has been supported by steady, unspectacular, but steady public inflows against a professional investment community that is waiting to see whether the plans that have been put out there and the ideas can actually execute.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Julian Emanuel. Greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.